Monster Man, episode 349. My Favorite Monster, with Ruth Tillman.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a special episode. It's one of my infrequent My Favorite Monster episodes, in which I sit down with game creators and talk to them about, well, I mean, I guess the title kind of says it, about their favorite monsters. My guest today is Ruth Tillman. Ruth is a librarian, crafter, and RPG writer. She's written scenarios for Trail of Cthulhu, Dracula Dossier for Knights Black Agents, Gumshoe 1-to-1 Cthulhu Confidential, and the upcoming Yellow King RPG sourcebook Black Star Magic. Her monster design work appears in the 13th Age Bestiary 2 and the Trail of Cthulhu Hideous Creatures supplement. And most recently, she's released her own monster zine, The Creeping Kudzu, and the storytelling game Snake People, a game of anticipatory grief. You can find more about her work on ArkhamArchivist.com, and I'll put a link to that down in the show notes. Ruth, welcome to Monster Man.
Thanks, James. I'm glad to be here today.
So I'm eager to talk to you about The Creeping Kudzu, but before we do that, I wanted to ask you a little bit about how you got into writing for role-playing games.
Yeah, so I started playing role-playing games when I was about 18, went off to college, fell in with a bad crowd of English majors. And so, you know, we started playing D&D together and had a number of adventures with that group. So then after college, I was trying to find people to play with when I moved to DC, and I ended up falling in with a number of game writers and the like. So eventually I had been playing some Pelgrane Press products, and I went up to their booth at Gen Con and said, oh, hey, I rewrote some of this stuff, and I've been having a really fun time running games for my friends here at Gen Con, because I was sort of setting it up as a place where a bunch of my friends were coming together. And they said, oh, we'd love to see some notes. And so it sort of spiraled from there to running games at Gen Con for Pelgrane, and then doing my own scenario writing.
The number of stories I've heard that begin with that, like, oh, hey, I really like your game, here's the ways I changed it, which which you wouldn't think, like, would be a successful opener, but apparently, I guess the spirit of game design is evident, right? And since then, you've been working kind of primarily on Gumshoe products, but I see that you have the Creeping Kudzu is statted both for Gumshoe and for Archmage, which is the 13th Age, like, that's their open system. Mm-hmm. How do you find the two experiences to be different, like, in terms of creating? Like, you've obviously if you have the same monster applied to both, how did you find the process of designing it for those two, not even so much the two systems as the two genres?
Yeah, I think some of it has to do with what kind of game you're going to be running. In an investigation game, the elements of the monster that affect you or affect other people or affect the world should probably come off pretty strongly in ways that underscore thematic horror elements. And so I sort of came up with my attacks. I based the monster in that world of, here are some of the ways in which it can affect either a person, or I specifically created some subsets of monster types or ways that it can affect people, so that there are either lower level fights to have or effects that you see in the real world. And so I based it in that investigative thing because I felt that that was where the biggest horror flavor came in. And then from there, I started thinking about, well, how could this be either a sort of one-off encounter that you have in a magical type forest situation that you're going through. Maybe you're doing something with elves. Maybe you're doing something where you're going to throw in myconids and other kinds of really natural-based monsters. Or something that you could build up the whole, again, campaign or idea around. And even my D&D type games right now, I've stepped in as the DM for a D&D 5e campaign that I was playing in. Even then, I try to make it kind of more problem solvy than trap solvy.
One of the features that I think you get when you have monsters in sort of investigative or investigative horror games is that a monster almost always implies a scenario. You very seldom just like, oh, and while we were on our way here, you know, we ran into some bugbears. Whereas you know, in a fantasy adventure game, they have that role of just kind of like implying a background level of threat and magic. So you might just kind of run into some bugbears on the way just to remind you that this is the kind of world in which there are bugbears and to let you kind of show off that you are brave warriors who can fight bugbears.
I just had some bugbears queued up for my level 4 players last week, just in case they needed an extra random encounter.
Yeah, exactly. Occasionally you run into the rowdy boys of the fantasy setting, my beloved bugbears. If it weren't for Bullywugs, they might be my favorite. You know what? I can't pick like that. That would be wrong. But having said that, I'm about to ask you to pick like that because I asked you to, you know, to pick a monster to talk about, and you wanted to talk about the aforementioned Creeping Kudzu. I thought this was a really interesting monster because of the way that it's rooted in, you know, real history and real ecology. Let me ask you, like, where do you start? Did you start with the monster's inspiration? Did you start with the historical kudzu? Or did you think, you know, I want to make a spreading threat that can cover a whole area. What if I made a kudzu-type monster?
I was thinking in the lines of genres and such. Mm-hmm. And so I am interested in sort of Afrofuturism, and I'm interested in alternate world reality, and I'm interested in ecology. Mm-hmm. And I have this vision sometimes of what would happen with, say, all the extra rain and water that we get here in central Pennsylvania and the like, and how the soil is predicted to become warmer, and how even as humans suffer in that, plant life can just flourish. And we had a summer of intense amounts of rain that had ruined the crops, which is a pretty big deal in Pennsylvania, as well as many other states. And we had so many mushrooms growing up. And so my brain was sort of full of all of these ideas. And I thought, well, what would happen if something like kudzu, you know, the vine that ate the South, moved up here? But what would happen if it started to like take over the natural environment, and how would it interact with people? And so it was really based on walking around and being in the world and sort of thinking about the intense wetness and greenness that I was living in, and then thinking through what that would look like as a monstrous entity, as sort of a way of coping with some of the predictions that I was reading, like that our soil would be more suited for cotton than corn in the next 40 years.
In fact, I realize I kind of jumped over this because I think most Americans know about it or sort of are aware of it. But for people who maybe didn't pay as much attention to kind of agricultural trivia as I did or aren't from the South, can you speak a little bit about the real world? Now, you say kudzu?
I say kudzu, yeah.
I've always said kudzu, but I have suddenly realized I have no reason for that. So I'm going to go ahead and assume it's kudzu. So every time I said kudzu previously, just forget about that. That didn't happen. So tell us a little bit about the real world, as you say, the vine that ate the South.
So it's a fascinating vine on its own, and it comes from Japan, where it is a native species, and as far as I know, does not cause any of the havoc that it causes here. But in the U.S., there was a Centennial Exposition of 1876, and they started saying, oh, look at this beautiful, you know, this beautiful plant. And they started marketing it to gardeners, and they would even plant it to deal with soil erosion. And what happened was the kudzu says, oh my goodness, this is wonderful soil. This is wonderful rain and heat and humidity. And so under ideal conditions, it can grow a foot a day.
That's 30 centimeters for my metric listeners.
It can go down 12 feet. If you cut it up, you just make more baby kudzu. And so I have a good friend who's a farmer, and we were talking about it at some point, and they just went off for a while about it. And so that's another one of those little seeds that had planted in my mind before I started building this as a monster, was what an incredibly difficult plant it is to get rid of. And this farmer was living in Virginia, where, you know, it's more of an issue.
Mm-hmm.
And their goats could eat it, but that's all that would eat it. So that also kind of was a fun post-apocalyptic kind of image of feeding your goats the kudzu. Or
good news for goats. Not so great for everybody else. I was reading about this, and they talked about how during the Great Depression, it was actually intentionally being planted, like the Civilian Conservation Corps, which was this sort of a combination, like public works and job creation program. that was part of the New Deal in the 1930s. They were going out, you know, intentionally, like planting as much kudzu as they could, but as you said, to prevent soil erosion, which was a big concern at the time. No one was thinking, what's this going to look like in 80 years?
Mm-hmm.
Because no one is ever thinking that. So then from there, you took this idea of this rapidly spreading weed and turned that into... I mean, it very much, like, I hope you'll take this in the right sense when I say that, like, I feel that this could have been, I sort of see it as like a horror movie from the 70s.
Oh, that's know? One of my favorite eras of horror movie, so.
But you know what I mean? Where there's kind of like, there was this raft of like, let's pick a thing in the natural world and then see if we can gin up some terror about it. And maybe I mean the early 80s. I don't know. I'm not a film historian. But you've taken it and turned it into this thing that, you know, like not only does it infiltrate the soil and the terrain, but it actually can get into other people. That, so, you know, some people are just kind of affected by it being all around them and they go a little strange. And then some people, the actual tendrils can graft themselves into a target and change it. And then there are like little sentient creatures that are actually spawned from the kudzu itself, which I really like because it's, again, it's a little monstrous ecosystem. It includes in itself that sense of escalation that you get in the structure of a horror or indeed of a fantasy adventure story where, you start with these kind of like, huh, these farm people sure are acting strangely. And then gradually you go up and up until you're finally confronting a whole glowing crater full of evil kudzu or whatever.
Yeah, that was definitely my intention. I think those 70s-esque horror films, I like the British Gothic ones, but I also like that series of sort of natural things. Maybe into the 80s too. I feel that they fit really well for RPG type stories. And I just find them enjoyable to sit around and watch popcorn on the couch with.
A lot of the things that we try to adapt into role-playing games are not necessarily very structured like role-playing games, but partly it may be the kind of anticipated play structure of a session where you don't want to do like survival horror games are difficult because you can't do them without credibly threatening to kill a character, but then nobody wants to get knocked out 90 minutes into a 4-hour session.
Right.
Whereas investigative horror games necessarily build toward a climax, which suits that structure a bit better. In the same way that the kind of like the escalating dungeon, like why is the dragon not in the first room of the dungeon? Why does he waste your time making you fight all of these increasingly powerful draconic opponents before you get to him? Like what's in it for him? But there, yeah, you absolutely get that sense of you turn up and the you know, shifty country folk look at you at the side of their eye, and then you find someone's diary and someone's like, oh, old man Jenkins certainly had an active imagination or whatever. And then, you know, before you know it, you're soaked in gasoline and throwing flares at a big thing full of kudzu. It just, it seems to be, it's one of those monsters that seems to suggest itself.
So one of the reasons that I picked the two kinds of attack that it has beyond your basic, you know, oh, it can trip you, it can choke you, it can ensnare you, was because the kudzu is such an invasive species that I thought it would be cool to have that concept of either having it psychically invade you, and yet that psychic invasion ties and connects you to other kinds of things. I think too about like root structures and how things in the natural world are more connected than we might see on the surface. But then also it can like physically graft itself into you, just again like the kudzu does into the soil. And I thought those were some fun ideas to again get that thematic idea of invasion and incursion. Although I have to say, for someone who periodically writes stuff like this, I don't actually like invasive body horror. So I'd probably lean more heavily on the psychic stuff in my own game, but I couldn't not see it. And so I had to put it in there too.
I agree. That stuff gives me the creeps. But like for that reason, it's effective, right?
Mm-hmm.
I like the illusion of boundaries between my body and the world around it.
Yes.
Exactly where it is. Like I'm aware that it's not true. But, you know, I'm comfortable maintaining that polite fiction, and I wish everyone else would as well.
yeah.
But, like, that's what a lot of horror-type monsters represent, is violations of the polite fictions, whether social or otherwise. But yes, I'm actually a giant wimp when it comes to horror gaming. I like to run them.
Yeah.
That's where my illusion of control comes from. Like, I've got it all written down here. I know what's going on. So I mentioned earlier your story game, Snake People, a game of anticipatory grief. What prompted you to design that?
So I had this image in my head. Then this, I feel like I need to say, was before the pandemic. The kinds of conversations that my friends and I, as what I would call elderly millennials, people in our mid to late 30s, were having about ourselves, about the world and the environment, about the next generation, the fact that there is a next generation that's starting to really come into being and thinking about what we want for them as people that we want good things for. And so I started to think about these conversations, and I eventually turned it into a game of six storytelling prompts where one person sets a statement that gives some background for the game, and then you all have to answer a question. And the questions are always the same, but the ways that the background goes and the ways that the story comes together can mean that I can sit down and play it with different groups and get very different kinds of worlds and stories. And it's about what happens when you're sitting down with all your friends after the world that you know has ended. And I wrote it in November, December 2019. I polished it up in January, and then I put it on ZineQuest in February. And then I fulfilled it during the first month of the pandemic, which was a little wild.
So it's called Snake People, and they're kind of the classic Lost Empire, right? Mm-hmm. Like, whether that's in, like, Call of the Conqueror or in, Call of Cthulhu, and even with, like, the Yuan Ti in Dungeons & Dragons, there's always this idea that, oh, here are these people who were once this mighty empire that stretched across the globe, and now, you know, evil pockets of them still lurk in the blah, blah, blah. And I, when I saw the title, it made me think of, like, kind of inhabiting that story from their perspective.
Yeah. And I liked that snake people could be something like a kobold.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the snake, you're a form of a kobold, right? So it could be very basic, very simple, very ordinary, or, like you say, it could be this previous civilizations. It could be somebody like Skyrim or Babylon 5 or Doctor Who, you know, properties that I could reference without naming the creature in the zine itself.
The Doctor Who reference was the other thing that that immediately occurred to me, right? Like, if it weren't for the fact that they wanted to kill everybody, they have a point.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've been talking about with a lot of people, you know, when we talk about this idea of monsters, and this kind of ties into the sort of ongoing discussion about, you know, player character quote-unquote races in games like Dungeons and Dragons, is that I think that there's been this notable change in perspective in the way that players relate to, you know, what would conventionally be called monsters. If you look at early games where you sort of play the monster, as it were, like monsters or whatever, like it's a joke, right? It's kind of it's a goof. It's a satire on other role-playing games. You know, maybe it's a post-vampire thing, but the use of kind of alien creatures to adopt either, like, other viewpoints, or in the case of what you're describing, viewpoints that do pertain to you, but maybe kind of you need a layer of narrative insulation to talk about. I don't know. It's fascinating to me, but that may be because I spend pound for pound more time thinking about monsters in role-playing games than the average person. I guess my last Creeping Kudzu related question is, so the Creeping Kudzu seems like, you know, a fascinating example of a monster that's inspired by observation, that's inspired by the world around you, that's inspired by history and ecology. I mean, is that something that you think is a feature of your games generally? Is that where you kind of mainly look for inspiration?
I think that I do end up getting a lot of inspiration from things that are somehow in my life. I talked about that a little bit with snake people, you know, that it was based on these conversations with other millennials, particularly around Gen X and what we wanted for them or what we wanted for the future. One of my earlier scenarios was sort of based a bit around the concept of coming to terms with the death of my mother. I've done things like that. But sometimes it really is just I run across a story or an idea and I think, oh, this would be fun, or historical research. That's my other big area of interest, is like diving into historical research. I have a really fun idea for something at some point when I found out that there was a joint Soviet-Canadian expedition to get a downed nuclear-powered thing in the Canadian north.
Mm-hmm.
Not 100% sure which part of the North, but I've got the project name written down. And someday, I think that would be a fun horror scenario to write.
I always use this metaphor of, like, it's the, like, the leaf litter, right? All the things that you that you read and learn and observe kind of form that fertile mulch going on in the back of your head.
And then the kudzu colonizes it and spreads and grows at the rate of a foot a day. And you're like, oh no, was this of alien origin? No, wait, this is just ordinary kudzu. Crap. It's still pretty bad.
Yeah. I mean, ordinary kudzu is arguably worse. It's like, it's not even a good story.
Yeah.
You know? It's just there. Oh, I got my brain mulch colonized by kudzu. Yeah, you and everybody else, buddy. So what's in the future for it? You know, what can we look forward to, if that's something that you are okay to talk about?
Yeah, that's a good question, because right now I feel like I'm on a bit of a break. Mm-hmm. Partly just because of the amount of brain power that writing something takes up. So I'm hoping that I'll get some small ideas for little monster zine type things, or maybe supplemental type material, but I'm definitely feeling, you know, the 1 year mark coming in on the pandemic and everything that comes with that.
It's fatiguing. It's just the things that you have to deal with, you know, that individually might not seem insurmountable, but they do add up. But let me jump off that to ask about your kind of monster zine experience. So you did this as something for Zine Quest 2.
The Snake People one, yes. The Creeping Cuts, it was just on my own.
Okay. Yeah. When you described Creeping Kudzu to me as a zine, and then I opened it up, I was like, oh, this is quite substantial. Like, I guess, you know, when I look at people's Zine Quest projects, they're often, you know, actually, like, they're books, really. But I opened it up, and it's 30 pages or whatever it is. It's 30 sometimes.
Yeah, it's just under 30 furiously. Pages, but minus the all the open licensing text I had.
Oh, yes, of course.
But yes, approximately 30 pages.
You know, that's a pretty substantial piece. So you just kind of, this was an idea that you just sort of was working on, you and you decided to just put it up on the internet and see if people liked it.
Yeah, I think that is one of the freeing ideas of the zine kind of thing, is I can work through it, I can iterate on it, I can decide how long or short I want it. You know, I did make this a 32 page printable booklet, which, you know, you've got some numbers in there around what you might, if you want to make it physical.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt that it was a flexible way for me to say, well, these are the systems I want to include, and this is about how much space I want to do for content. And it was a nice alternative. And I think it was like some of the earlier stuff that we see in RPGs, right? Where people would publish things in magazines, or they'd put their own little thing out, say in the early 90s. And mm-hmm. that's where some of the bigger names in modern publishing got started. Just doing their own little things, putting them out there, seeing what took. And mm-hmm. it felt pretty low stakes. So with the Creeping Kudzu, I just made that a stretch goal in the Snake People game, because I had already created it. And
right.
So I was just like, well, I can get them printed nicer than my own printer if I just get, you know, if I add them as a stretch goal here. And a lot of people were interested. So, and I have a little scenario that I wrote for it too.
I like the, so you called it low stakes, which I think is a really interesting way of putting it, because I think that that's exactly right about sort of the early RPG market. You see this in other things as well, early on in role-playing games, because role-playing games are, I mean, first, no one knows what they are, and second, even if anyone did, they're not serious art. No one cares what people are doing in them.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of early RPG material is forgettable. Like, I'm fascinated by it at a historical level, and I, you know, I study it with a certain amount of rigor. I'm more invested in it than most people, and I'll tell you that a lot of it's forgettable. But what it is this incredibly rapid, like, stuff gets thrown out and it sinks or swims, and somebody picks it up somewhere and they like it, or they don't.
Mm-hmm.
And this is happening because, I mean, no one's sure what you're supposed to be doing, and no one's paying attention. This is also what I like about old comic books. Or, like, B-movies, right? Like, you know, Roger Corman gave you a budget and a length, and he did not express any opinions about what it was supposed to be like. The fact that the stakes are low is liberating.
Yeah, like, if five people like it, that's fine. You know, I don't have to sell 1,000 copies. It definitely helped to do some published writing, get editorial feedback, get some mentoring from other people in the field, because I think that set me up to feel more confident to do it myself. Rob Heinze, for example, my first published monster, I had done the little monster design on my blog for 13th Age, and he invited me to write something for the Bestiary 2. And I was very much like, Rob, I don't make monsters. I write scenarios. I don't make monsters. I write setting material. I don't make monsters. And he was like, you kind of do, though. So make me a monster. And so working with that, getting some feedback, that was really helpful to then say, oh, I do make monsters. Okay, here's another like whole monster setting set up where I brought in all of the feedback and edits and work I'd put into thinking about how to do scenarios and playtesting and that sort of thing. So I think there's a real benefit to working with publishers and getting a certain amount or just getting that mentoring, however you get it. And then, yeah, it's just freeing to throw stuff out there and go, I don't know, it's Creeping Kudzu. Do other people find that as freaky as I do?
And so is it something that you're thinking of doing? You possibly said this a moment ago. Is it something you're thinking of doing more of? Creating more of these little independent projects?
Yeah, well, I do have this one this is like a little drama system setting, right? It's one of the many smaller projects that I've done that I didn't list in my bio is, you know, I've written
a pitch,
and I'm forgetting the name for what they're called, but like a little drama system, a drama system pitch. And so I have a whole idea for the other drama system pitch, because when I wrote mine, I gave them two ideas and I said, here's two ideas. And they said, well, this one's more unique. And I said, great, I'll do this one. So the other one is just still sitting there, and I occasionally scribble down little notes about it. So that's the kind of thing too, that you can publish as a scene, mm-hmm. because it's so little and weird and standalone. And so, yeah, I'm thinking that I am going to keep my eyes open for, you know, other ideas for monsters, little scenarios that can be made into just a couple of pages or a concept, a drama system pitch, something like that. So if I could do one thing in 2020, that would be fine by me.
I hate to tell you that it's 2021.
I was going to, I was thinking 2021 when I said it.
Yeah, this other stuff is all already from 2020, so that's fine, right?
Yeah.
But that's I'm leaving that in because it very much encapsulates the feeling of early 2021. That's kind of where we all are at present. What an upbeat yet wearily realistic note to go out on. Again, very in keeping with the spirit of the age. My guest today has been Ruth Tillman. Ruth, thank you so much for coming on the show. Before we go, can you tell the listeners where they can find you online and find more of your work?
So the best place to find my work online right now is arkhamarchivist.com, and I'm not particularly active on social media at this point, so...
A wise decision. I salute it.
Yeah, I've had places that you can get me, but probably just check Arkham Archivist. If I write a new blog post or anything, it'll go up there.
All right, fantastic. In our next episode, we'll be returning to our ongoing journey through Creature Catalog, the 1986 supplement for Basic Dungeons & Dragons. And if I've got my math right, we'll be just beginning the undead section. So it's undead monsters created by people who weren't satisfied with the ones that were already in the Beckmeek. But yeah, I'm actually quite looking forward to it. So please join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons attribution license. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.